The News Dissector with Danny Schechter, Fridays at 1 p.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network.
The sound of the New York Police Department confronting protesters at Zuccotti Park. Let's hear it. The midnight raid of Michael Bloomberg, not Paul Revere, but Michael Bloomberg's NYPD, coming into the park, truncheons swinging, stuff being destroyed, and people being evicted from Zuccotti Park, Liberty Plaza, the home base of Occupy Wall Street.
I wish you guys knew, because you are us, we are you. And we're going to make this change, guys. We need all of you guys. We need all of you. We need us to stand together. Don't fight us, guys.
It was a tragedy in some respects, maybe something that actually can work out for the best. It was the raid on Zuccotti Park. It's part of what we're going to be talking about on this week's News Dissector Radio Hour here on ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com. We're going to be talking to some of the activists who have been in Zuccotti Park, including our own Catherine Waters, who's in the studio with me. I'm going to be talking about some of my own reporting on what's happened here. You're listening to the Dissector, Danny Schechter here on PRN FM.
Because this is where they buy the politicians. Because this is where the power has its seat. Because 99% of us are suffering at the mercy of the madmen on this street. Because all of us are victims of class warfare being waged on us by the 1%. Because these greedy banksters rob the country, leaving us without the means to pay the rent. Because the last time that we had a decent government was about 1932. Because we the people are supposed to run this country, but instead it's all run by and for the few. Because now we know the rich do not pay taxes, but when they need a hand, it's us who bail them out. Because we suspected we lived in a plutocracy, but suddenly of late there is no doubt, and so we're gonna stay.
One of the songs inspired by the Occupy movement by David Rovics. It's quite good. You can check it out, R-O-V-I-C-S, on YouTube. I've played it on this program before. I'm playing it again. I'm pleased to be joined today by two activists of the Occupy Wall Street movement who have been monitoring closely everything that's happening there, have been involved very deeply, and we'll be hearing from others as well. But joining me now from the great borough of Queens in New York City, Ian Escuela, and from Long Island, David DeGraw, who's the person credited with coining the phrase the 99% versus the 1%. Good morning, gentlemen.
Good afternoon, Jack.
How's it going, Danny?
Good. You're here, and you were with me last night, or I was with you last night, in Foley Square, capping a day of national action. Let's just give a little reprise to our audience about what happened last night and yesterday here in New York.
Who do you want to take that?
Why don't you start, David? Ian, hop in, and then I'll join you.
All right, well, yesterday was, we've had some really incredible days of action in the past 2 months, but yesterday was just probably the most impressive day of action that I've seen. Early in the morning, we had people gathering around Wall Street. It was very intense. We've had people all throughout the financial district doing different actions. Later in the day, occupied the subways. People spoke to people on the subways about the Occupy movement. We had various actions at Liberty Park, reclaiming the park, and back and forth with the police. We did have a good amount of arrests, so all in all, people remained peaceful. At Foley Park, I think the police estimated that there was 32,000 people there, but I would say that there was probably at least 40,000 people at Foley Square, and a bunch of people marched over the Brooklyn Bridge. We had the Occupy Wall Street bat signal go up on the side of the Verizon building, which, you know, said we are the 99% and talked about all the different Occupy locations. So, I mean, it was a day filled with many actions. There's probably a dozen or so actions I didn't even mention. Maybe Ian can jump in on that.
Ian Escuela.
You pretty much got them well covered for the most part. I mean, it was beyond even a double-decker or triple-decker. The whole day was just filled nonstop with just various people and various groups coming out in support of us, doing various things. And after what transpired the last couple of days, it was really heartening to me to see the city of New York in a very broad sense, or at least in the broadest sense to date, I think, come out in support of us and do various things to let the mayor and the powers that be know that we're not going anywhere, and they will be hearing from us on a constant basis.
Yesterday was called N17, and it was a special day of protests, not just in the United States, but worldwide. 30,000 people were said to be marching in Greece, and protest student strikes in Spain, many other actions around the world. I don't have a full list of what they are. Yesterday, after Foley Square, a tremendous number of people marched over the Brooklyn Bridge, the very bridge that people were denied access to and were tricked into going into the roadway to be arrested. Some 700 to 800 people were arrested on that day. So they sort of took the bridge back, marching to Brooklyn. There was a tremendous sense of euphoria, but there was also other marches out of Foley Square. Catherine Waters was there when they marched up to 14th Street. Tell us a little bit about that, because it was unusual. They took the street, not just the sidewalk.
Right. I was there down at Ducati Park when the march began, going up to Union Square. And, yeah, we peacefully, I mean, the cops didn't, you know, they didn't try to keep everybody on the sidewalk, or maybe they just gave up. I think there was just too many people. So we, during the march, like up to Union Square, I mean, people just took to the streets and, you know, and were marching like in between cars. I mean, like literally stopping like all the traffic. And the traffic didn't seem to mind. I mean, people in buses and cars were like honking like for the protesters. So there was a lot of support.
That was reported also on the Brooklyn Bridge. By the way, an announcement, everybody, from the Occupy Wall Street website. If you were present when the NYPD attacked Liberty Square or Zuccotti Park in the middle of the night to destroy the encampment and destroy people's homes and tents and tarps and even the people's library, today is the last day the city is willing to return what personal possessions they may still have. And that's happening today between 8 and 4, Manhattan District 7 Garbage Department, 650 West 56th Street in Manhattan. So you can go down there and try to see if they have any of your stuff. A lot of things were just trashed, thrown into the garbage trucks, and hauled away. You know, it was ironic to me, David, because here the city was, you know, talking about the property rights of Brookfield Realty, which, you know, owns Zuccotti Park, and we can't violate those rights after all. And then the personal property rights of the individuals were just basically neutered by the NYPD, as well as the right to peace. Peacefully assembled, the right to free speech, you know, and also, you know, just the right of the free press even was circumscribed when reporters weren't allowed into the park to actually cover what was going on the weirdest pretext I've yet to hear. You know, during operations, reporters can't be present. This is a completely new NYPD invention by the mayor and Ray Kelly, the police chief, because when you get a press card, everybody who gets a press card is individually interviewed by the New York Police Department. Those press cards allow you, the whole point of having it is to be able to operate behind police lines. They know who the people who have the cards are. They've interviewed them all, and yet that right was revoked by the police unilaterally, you know, with no respect whatsoever. Something like 23 or 26 journalists have been arrested in these various encampments. David, what do you think this says about, you know, both Bloomberg and the activists?
Well, I mean, you know, it comes down to constitutional rights being violated over and over again. You know, I haven't been really involved on the legal end. Ian could probably speak much clearer about the different legal issues. But, you know, I was just looking through a bunch of videos this morning of the actual eviction. And, I mean, the way they came in there, just, you know, in the dead of night, with very little warning, you know, they basically said, all right, you got an hour to get everything and get out. And then, you know, they just came charging in. The way they were throwing everyone's, you know, personal possessions around, you know, people were living there. You know, I mean, this was, you know, for some people it was all their personal belongings, and the cops just were taking it from them, throwing it in a huge pile. It was amazing to me that people remain disciplined enough to not have that turn into a riot scene. And to see that, you know, the cops started using that, I forget what they call it.
The LRADs.
Yeah, the LRAD sound device. You know, there was, like, young children in the park, and I mean, it was just really brutal.
This is an ear-splitting sound. Again, ironic, because one of the big complaints of the Bloomberg administration is that there was too much noise in the park, you know, that it was interfering with the neighborhood.
I think it's important to note that, you know, most of the loud noises comes from the police. Even with these marches, you know, everyone gets so upset, like, oh, you know, the protesters are blocking the streets, and it's the New York Police Department in their over-the-top actions that have barricaded off block after block after block. I mean, it's so excessive, over-the-top.
Shutting down subways as well.
Exactly. I mean, it's the police department that's going out of their way to make people's life difficult. You know, maybe they're trying to make us look bad, maybe they're just overly protective, I don't know, but I mean, every time the cops do something incredibly over the top and aggressive against us, it just re-energizes the movement, you know. That 1 week in on that Saturday the 24th when the girls got pepper sprayed, you know, our numbers doubled after that. When 700 people were tricked on the Brooklyn Bridge, our numbers doubled after that. When Scott Olsen in Oakland had that horrible situation where he got hit in the head with a gas canister or whatever it was. I mean, again, you know, it spread the movement. This old lady, 84-year-old lady, gets pepper sprayed in the face. I mean, these things are insane, and it just makes the movement grow. I mean, it's a shame that these things are happening to people, but every time they do this, the movement just grows exponentially.
Ian, any thoughts on that, too?
Yeah, oh, I'd love to jump in on this. I think the level of violence is relative to the threat, and it's really indicative of the systemic decay, and it's really the only card they have to play. They cannot make publicly an argument in support of their own positions, and it shows in the level of violence. If I remember correctly, Malcolm X said that they are violent when their interests are threatened, and I like to think, and I do think, we are, in fact, well along in at least past the first stage of solidifying a base to, in both in the short term and the long term, threaten their interests. And so on the legal front, I really think that just their actions and the lip service they pay to the Constitution, et cetera, really lays bare their claims. And it does so in a very public manner. And it shows that they are not responsive, that those protections really don't apply to the citizenry in a broad sense. They've been co-opted and grabbed by the powered money elite. Those are the people that have their freedom of speech, that have their property rights, and those people are certainly willing to deny those things to the rest of us in service of maintaining their rights.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think you zero in on something important because, you know, at the same time that all of this is going on Wall Street, investigators are looking for $600 million in money from the MK
IMF Global,
you know, company run by John Corzine, where the money of customers was basically taken by the company to cover their various bets and speculation and wheeling and dealing. And you know, $600 million, apparently, Gerald Celente, who's one of the... pardon me?
Celente.
Yeah, Celente, sorry, with a C. I know, I'm sorry, Gerald, for saying, mispronouncing your name. Anyway, you know, he apparently had an investment with that company, which was taken without his knowledge or without his permission. And so, you know, the corruption on Wall Street, the scale of it is unimaginable to most Americans, and yet it's continuing. It hasn't been investigated. No CEOs have been arrested. You don't see a perp walk on Wall Street of these CEOs getting, you know, taken by the police. Instead, you know, college kids are being rounded up and hit on the head and mangled in these protests. And that's part of the outrage here and the gap, you know, in economic justice between, you know, people who are trying to stand up for what's right and people who are actually committing what's wrong on a regular basis, which is ongoing with no intervention whatsoever. And it seems like this message is getting through to people. You know, I write a blog every day on NewsDissector.com, and well, today there was a little item. I don't know if you saw this, David or Ian, Catherine, that there was a report on one of the TV networks that there was a plot to take over the subway, to disrupt the subways in New York, which and the anchor man was the son of Ray Kelly, the police commissioner. It was a completely bogus report, and yet, you know, it was clearly leaked by his dad and the police department to create more fear and to basically drive public opinion against Occupy Wall Street, when in fact public opinion seems to be supporting Occupy Wall Street. That's you know, the irony of all of this. Is there a kind of a silver lining maybe in Bloomberg's attack on the encampment, Ian?
Oh, absolutely. As Dave was alluding to a minute ago, everything they do will make us stronger. Everything they do. Because I generally believe people are good people, do have moral compasses, by and large, and people cannot help but be repulsed every time that they see this amount of force and the manner in which it's deployed against people who are nonviolent. They will react, whether they do so overtly in the form of coming down to the park, sending a donation, talking to each other about it. Every time that they attempt to use force and disturb us and whatever we're doing and just generally take any action against us, it will, in my thinking, make us stronger definitionally.
I think as long as the protests remain nonviolent, good-spirited, clear about, you know, their analysis, I think it resonates with the public. And what I was struck by last night at Foley Square, you know, initially, remember when all this started, they were saying, you know, this is just a bunch of white kids with nothing better to do. When you looked at that park yesterday, you saw workers of every race and every background out there militantly supporting Occupy Wall Street and taking up, in a sense, the phrase that you helped coin, David, you know, the 99% and the 1%. How did that make you feel?
It's been outrageous, you know. I mean, the amazing thing about all of this is that even among the core organizers of Occupy Wall Street, you know, a lot of them didn't even know what the 99% movement was. They just kind of adapted the phrase and ran with it. You know, I mean, as you know, Danny, for the past year and a half, we've had this 99% movement where, you know, we've been trying to unite people across the political spectrum, whatever your political opinions might be. There's plenty of room for common ground. And, you know, it was really all about restoring accountability, leveling the playing field, you know, getting money out of politics, breaking up the banks. These things that whether you're a progressive, libertarian, communists, socialists, anarchists, you know, people will come together and agree on things. You know, everyone knows that the system is broken. You know, even people well within the top 1% they know the system is broken, and they look at this movement, and they understand that this movement is attempting to address all the side effects of a broken and corrupted system. So, you know, we have people coming from well within the top 1% who are reaching out with an olive branch right now, trying to help this movement and see how they can fit into it. Because, look, everyone understands the system's broken. Everyone understands it's unsustainable. So, you know, I mean, this movement it's almost inevitable. You know, we thought that this would start 3 years ago, but, you know, now that it's finally started, you know, I mean, yeah, I've been doing the 99% framing to try and show people that we are the overwhelming majority and that if we organize and fight, we can easily win this because we have power in numbers. But, you know, it really is about 100% of us, you know, because we're all on the Titanic together here, and we all got to work together and figure this out as soon as possible.
I think one of the appeals here, Catherine, you're welcome to jump in here, but one of the appeals here is to recognize that we're not just fighting for ourselves. We're not just a few handful of people, activists, whatever, but we actually are fighting in the name of the majority of the people in this country who are being hurt and often don't really even know how and why because the media doesn't really explain it to them.
And we're even fighting for the cops that are fighting against us, whether they realize it or not.
I mean, that's an interesting observation. There was a former Philadelphia police captain who was in the protest at Wall Street yesterday who was arrested. Had come over from the police side to the people side in a way. And this is something that I think we're probably going to see more of, you know, as this movement continues to mature and to grow. One of the points that I think I was trying to raise before, maybe you could both comment on, is, you know, this was not a movement, was not really about the right to camp, the right to, you know, have a tent and sleep all night in a park. That was a way of drawing attention to issues, or at least that was the idea, even though much of the media made that the issue. And now that the park is less, you know, accessible, if you will, for people to actually live in it, it may actually be good in terms of giving more attention or allowing people who want to bring more attention to the issues to bring it. Do you guys agree with that?
Ian, you want to jump in?
Well, might as well. I think absolutely. I mean, there is a very broad awareness. I mean, after the internet bubble, and certainly after the housing bubble, on the largest level. I mean, granted, there are graduated levels of awareness and analysis, but after those two events, and just in the context of people's own personal lives as far as their wage, their salary, access to employment, housing, etc., on the largest level possible, and perhaps in no period and even maybe even greater than the Great Depression, people are viscerally aware of the fact that the system in which our society is operating, a system which our society is operating under, is hurting them and is hurting their loved ones, and it's unescapable.
Yeah, I mean, that's what I'm finding also when you talk to a lot of, quote, ordinary people. You know, I got the surprising response. You know, they're not involved. They're not camping. They're not in the park. They're not marching in the streets. But they say, you know, it's about time this issue was raised. It's about time we stand up to these people on Wall Street. I heard this on New York One last night. There was a, you know, call-ins and whatnot, and, you know, two people kind of knee-jerk right-wing, you know, people attacking, why don't they get a job kind of thing, you know, occupy a desk, buddy, you know, this kind of attitude. This woman called in from somewhere. She says, listen, this is so demeaning. This is so ignorant. Don't you know why this whole thing is happening? Don't you know what's happened on Wall Street? Don't you know about, you know, mortgage fraud and all the rest of it? In other words, she was educating the network as well as the audience about this, and they tried to say, well, thank you very much. No, she just kept going. She wouldn't be shut up until she made her point, and I think we're seeing a lot more of that.
I just wanted to say really quickly, Max Kaiser said it too, that it's the people that have the jobs are doing like a lot of the screwing to the average person. So when people say like, oh, get a job, it's like, yeah, get a job with doing what? You know, screwing over the average person?
Well, I'm not against people who are working. I mean, we do need more jobs. But what we also need is to understand this larger system. Now, David, one of the things that I think it would be good to just remind people of, you know, you pioneered on this issue. You wrote some really definitive books and work on it. How can people get hold of it? Is there a website they can go to download or to find out about how to get your work?
Well, my work is primarily at my blog, which is daviddegraw.org. I also had a primary site, AMPED Status, A-M-P-E-D. Status.com. I haven't updated that site much lately because I've been working on a new project, which is a new site for the Occupy Wall Street movement. That's called owsnews.org. It's a project we just started. It's in conjunction with many different occupations throughout the country. We're just really getting ramped up. Haven't really done much outreach for it yet, and we got different projects in the pipeline to do with the site. But owsnews.org, moving forward, is going to be my primary website as far as, you know, unfortunately, since this movement has started, I've only written maybe three different reports.
I think you've been a little busy.
Yeah, I mean, between, you know, just a flood of people coming out of the woodwork wanting to be involved in the movement.
Well, I know that,
it's overwhelming.
I know that both of you, I know that I, you know, kind of worry for the movement, want to see, you know, it progressing, want to see it deepening its outreach, particularly to mainstream America. But at the same time, when you take a look at just what's happened in just 2 months, it is really amazing. Agree? I mean, it's inspiring and it's heartening to those of us who've been waiting, hoping that something like this would come along.
Well, I think we're dealing with inevitability here. There's only so much wealth that can be extracted, only so much pain that can be brought to bear on a population until that population reacts to it and says enough.
Well, guys, listen, just stay with me for a minute. We have to take a break here to remind people what they're listening to and about some of the other shows on PRN. And then we'll be back in a minute with more on Occupied Wall Street. Don't go away.
Advisory side of my business. I knew what I was doing was wrong, indeed criminal.
The shine on America's shoes got gold.
When Wall Street stepped into the fold,
Congress paid off, workers laid off.
Stanford, AIG, and Madoff.
Credit swaps, credit stops, empty wallets, and empty shops, and bank walking to AAA.
Grandpa loses 401k.
Plunder, the theme song of my film, Plunder, The Crime of Our Time, available at plunderthecrimeofourtime.com, a film about the financial crisis as a crime story, not just a business problem. And that's, in a sense, an understanding that is powering the Occupy movement, because they recognize you know, that this is a something that has happened because some people who were in position to do so cheated so many other people. And that's why we talk about the 1% and the 99%. Joining our conversation with David DeGraw, Ian Escuela, Catherine Waters, myself, Danny Schechter, your news dissector, is from the state of New Jersey, across the river, Goldie, a musician and an activist at OWS. Goldie, good morning, good afternoon, good day. Thanks for joining us. Thanks for joining us. Just your sense of the action last night, your feeling about the rhythm of this. As an artist, you must see the energy here as something that to be discussed.
Oh, to be discussed, not disgusted, right?
Absolutely.
It's just a grammar thing. Yeah, let's discuss. It was an amazing day yesterday. I mean, we started out with about 500 people at 7 a.m., and then every hour that went by just grew and grew and grew. And, you know, the police were really brazen on Wall Street. It was, you know, head-to-head battles with human chains trying to block down intersections and shut down business. We definitely succeeded in slowing it down. And then as the day went on, the battles started, we gained momentum, we gained people, and the battle started going our way, and, you know, we shoved the police out of Zuccotti Park, we shoved them out of Union Square, and then, in the end, they just succumbed down by the Brooklyn Bridge and Foley Square, and just tried to be as calm as possible, because they would have had hell on their hands if they did anything stupid like they tried in the morning.
And they were dealing with, you know, trade union people, you know, who are, you know, basically, you know, extremely militant and very committed and supporting OWS. I think that was one of the unique things about this, to see so many different generations supporting each other. We have three phone lines open, so somebody's making a little noise there. Ian, your take on this alliance between unions and activists of the Occupy movement.
Well, it's another thing that's inevitable. I mean, for the past, what we're seeing now is maybe, I wouldn't go so far as to say it's the culmination of 40 years. I do think things will get much worse before we get a full victory. But labor, I mean, anybody that even remotely knows anything about labor knows their ranks have been dwindling, that our political elites have been doing nothing on a legislative level, on a public perception advertising level, to diminish our civil servants, diminish our tradesmen, and they are a natural common ally. I mean, they're a part of our population, and for the last 40 years, they've been on the wane.
Isn't this sort of suggesting, you know, the next phase or another strategy here for OWS, David, to basically reach out to mainstream America, to not just talk to ourselves and the people who are hip and cool and on Twitter and social media, but ordinary Americans in, you know, working class communities, mainstream neighborhoods, the suburbs in America, suburban towns who are suffering as a result of this financial crisis? Are we in a position to try to create some media that can reach them?
Absolutely. You know, and just dealing with some of the, you know, one percenters, be they, you know, Hollywood celebrities, musicians, or, you know, well-established politicians. Yeah, as I was saying before, you know, everyone realizes the system is broken, and we are, you know, as part of our next phase of strategy, we are looking at ways in which we can occupy the mainstream, so to speak. You know, it's always a delicate balance, because it's an issue of, you know, who speaks for the movement and what exactly do you say on behalf of the movement. And also, when you deal with, you know, kind of high-profile celebrities and artists and also elected officials, there's a delicate balance between, you know, being, you know, filled with hypocrisy, kind of it's a tightrope to walk. Essentially what you're trying to do is brand the movement, or, you know, craft these media messages. And, you know, as I said, it's just a very delicate balance of doing that in a way that maintains the integrity and genuine, you know, genuine stature of the movement without, you know, being a sellout, without being co-opted. I mean, because these are all real fears that we face. You know, we don't want to be co-opted by either of the political parties. We don't want to be co-opted by any one group, however wonderful they might be. So it's a delicate balance, but moving forward, you're going to see more of this, you know, penetration into the average hearts and minds of the average American. It has to happen.
I mean, you've been hanging out a little bit, David, just on this point with that military man who spoke out in Times Square in a video that went viral. Tell me a little bit about that, because it seems like people in the armed forces who are coming back from Iraq, finding that there are no jobs for them, that are, you know, very few support services and the rest, might be open to participating in this movement.
Right. I mean, from the very beginning, when we first started with this 99% movement, some of our biggest supporters have been either veterans of Iraq and Afghanistan, even some active duty soldiers, you know, because they've been on the battlefield. They've seen, you know, they've traveled the world. You know, they've seen, you know, the horrific realities of the, you know, brutal empire that we've become, and just the consolidation of wealth and power into such a tiny global financial elite. They've seen this all firsthand. And they've paid the price for it. So, you know, whether it's Occupy Marines or just someone like Shamar Thomas, Sergeant Shamar Thomas coming down and, you know, dressing down the police, you know, for their brutality against peaceful protesters.
I mean, he had.
I mean, there's plenty of people in the military. They know the score, and they know that this movement's legit, and we're standing up for. We're really defending the American people against an occupying global financial oligarchy. I mean, that might sound like a little too conspiracy theory, but it's the truth. And soldiers get it. They, you know, they, we see these signs. This is the second time I fought for my country. The first time I've known the enemy. I mean, these guys get it. I mean, the soldiers get it. And
have you spoken to some of these soldiers, Kat?
Yeah, I actually did meet Shamar, Sergeant Shamar Thomas, down at Zuccotti. I sent him an email inviting him to come on the show. I'm going to have to send him another one. I think he's been a bit busy since that video aired on YouTube and got quite a bit.
Shamar's a rock star now.
Yeah,
he's
got
groupies and everything going after him. It's amazing, amazing. And he's the most humble, down to earth, you know, intelligent, you know, just really a sweet guy. I mean,
yeah, he comes to the park and he sits in on the think tanks and a lot of the groups and participates down there at the park.
So I mean, I think what we're seeing here is that this movement has this appeal. It resonates with so many different kinds of people in a multi-generational way. I mean, you had sort of gray heads and bald heads and young kids. People across the spectrum of American life seem to find something in this movement to connect with, to feel that it's a community in which they are welcome to take part. That's something very unusual and unique. I mean, there have been a lot of movements going on in America for a long time that haven't really developed any traction. Here we are, 2 months in, the second anniversary of Occupy Wall Street, and it's rocking, you know, in terms of doing more than ever, in a way, than it did before, despite everything that's been thrown against them. And I don't, David, personally underestimate the potential of, you know, a frightened power structure to crack down on, you know, on activists. Already in some states, they are, you know, putting down felony indictments against people, or trying to, you know, repress this movement in a serious way. There's been indications of coordination involving the Department of Homeland Security, different cities consulting with each other and all the rest of it, what to do about this. And you know, in my experience, you know, is that whenever you expect the system to act in a rational and reasonable way, you're probably, you know, expecting the wrong thing, because their whole instinct is when their prerogatives are challenged, is to lash back and fight back in a vicious way, whether it's legal or not.
Right. Well, I mean, obviously, as we spent the first 10 minutes discussing, Yeah, that's the only card they have left to play. I mean, and every time they play that card, the public just turns against them more. So yeah, they're going to step up the surveillance and the crackdowns, especially, you know, wait till the spring comes. Let me tell you, if you think we're effective now, wait till March comes in April, and I mean, we're going to be an unstoppable force. So yeah, we're going to see some desperate attempts to crack down on us. But, you know, as we've also been saying in this conversation, the inevitability of this movement, I mean, it might sound arrogant or grandiose, but we are unstoppable. I mean, the system is broken. Everyone gets it. And, you know, they could lash out at us all they want. And, you know, like we keep using that line, you know, you can kill a person, but you can't kill an idea. And the idea has taken hold, and it's not, they can't stop it. And the more violent they are, the more the movement grows.
Goldie, what kind of feedback are you getting from your friends and people that you speak to?
I'm getting great feedback, but just getting back to this point, you know, one great thing about America is at least right now, they can't just kill us in the streets and disappear us. And we had, you know, 40,000 people there last night in a show of support. And the way a regime would work to silence a movement like this would be to instill an incredible amount of fear. And I hope America is civilized enough to not allow that to happen, to not pull a Syria on us. And if that's the case, we'll win, you know. Because we don't have any fear, and that's, you know, there's been a couple, I've spoken to a couple dejected people. We had a lot of new people come down on Wednesday. They just arrived, and they're sitting in the rain with another 100 people around them wondering where the movement is. And I explained to all of them that this is the movement. It's all around you. This is how it started, you know, 50, 100 people in the rain, you're hammering out our documents, our declarations. And that, you know, I assured them that this is a beautiful thing. I mean, you know, so
flashback with me, Goldie, flashback with me to September 17th when this movement started. Did anybody have any idea that it could take on the force that it has and the momentum that it has?
You know, I don't think so at all. I mean, it started out in the afternoon, a few hundred people. I think everybody was immediately like, what the hell is going on? This isn't enough to start a revolution. Then it filled up to 1,000 people at night. And then we just thought the cops were going to move in, and we were surrounded by hundreds of cops all the way around the block, just locked, you know, just looking at us, ready to beat our heads in. And but then when they did not invade the at 9:30, they announced they're not going to invade the park. They're going to let us stay. And everything changed. It was like, oh my God, we just won something. Everybody went crazy. And then the movement, something was possible. We got our first concession from, you know, the NYPD police state. So at that point on, everything shifted. But no, I don't. I think before that point, everyone thought we were just going to lose. I mean, I hate to speak for everybody, but you know, things like this don't happen every day. They don't happen every year. They don't happen every decade, you know? This is a really, really unique and amazing thing that's happening. And that's why we're all excited as hell and pumped up that, you know, 40,000, 50,000, I don't know how many thousands of people were in Foley Square last night, but it was amazing.
Yeah, but think about it also in national terms. I mean, there have been marches and actions and encampments and, you know, protests on campuses and communities.
I heard a stat that they were estimating that 9 million people have taken part in the Occupy movement since December 17th.
Wow.
Is that worldwide?
I think it's just the U.S. It might be worldwide,
yeah.
Too. I mean, that's a huge number. I don't know. I just heard that.
Well, you know,
yeah.
I mean, we saw, the just before the Iraq War, the ability of the world to mobilize to try to stop that war, you know, with millions of people who weren't listened to. But it seems as if, you know, that was a one-shot, you know, one-day protest, everybody went home. This is a movement that's ongoing, continuing, and mobilizing. Just very quickly, I'd like to just go around to everyone to give me a little bit of a forecast of where you think things are going. And then I'm going to play a little excerpt from a documentary that I did inside the Zuccotti Park, the Zuccotti Park that was and maybe will be one day again. So let's just do that wraparound to various people, starting with you, David.
About the future of the movement, I mean, as I've been saying through this interview, I mean, I think it's limitless. People from every walk of life, from, you know, the 100% are coming forward, and they want to help, and everyone knows the system's broken. Come this, I think, you know, you're going to see over the next 2-3 months, you're going to see more things as far as national organization, more... you know, trying to craft a message that is inclusive for everyone, to penetrate the mainstream in various ways, be it television, you know, documentaries, music. So I think over the winter you're going to see a lot of this mainstreaming, getting into the average hearts and minds. And then come the spring, I think we, you know, I mean, we had 40,000 people at Foley Square. I mean, come the spring, we'll have 140,000.
So you see a spring offensive, as it used to be called.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, going into your last question, I was very depressed going into September 17th. You know, we tried and failed so many times, and but we knew we just had to keep fighting because there really was no alternative. And to see the way it's blown up, I mean... It's here now. It's inevitable. It's happening. And I am extraordinarily positive and inspired. And I think this thing's going to be huge moving forward.
Quickly, Ian, a thought.
Oh, I could not agree more with David. Come springtime, if they think they have trouble on their hands now, they haven't seen anything yet.
Catherine?
Oh, it's definitely going to gain more and more leverage, and the Titanic is going to right itself back up again.
And Goldie?
I think the Occupy movement needs to have a really permanent status in our society to affect the change, for that very reason, that anything temporary doesn't seem to last. And we don't need Band-Aids on the system. We need a cultural change in the way we think and the way we value ourselves.
Well, there you are, you know, a roundup of activists who've been part of the Occupy Wall Street movement, Goldie in New Jersey, David DeGraw in Long Island, Ian Escuela in Queens, New York, Catherine Waters in the studio with me. I'm Danny Schechter, your news dissector. I just want to give you a little taste of a film that I did that is available online on YouTube, Press TV YouTube. Inside Zuccotti Park, behind the scenes, what was actually happening? How was it organized? I want to give you a little taste of it. You can actually see it for yourself online, but this is part of it.
This is it. Occupied Wall Street in downtown Manhattan, 2 blocks from the real center of financial power in the world. Behind the scenes at Occupy Wall Street is an organization that's pretty invisible. It's decentralized. It's bottom up. It's organized into working committees. Yet it's created an infrastructure in direct democracy that we're going to show you in this In Focus report.
Here's where we are. This is the map of Lower Manhattan in New York's financial district. And this is Zuccotti Park, owned by a private realty company and named after a real estate executive. It sits on a half acre of ground that was damaged by the 9/11 attack on the nearby World Trade Center. In the morning, activists asleep on cold granite are waking up. Like hotel guests, these occupiers of Wall Street have their own concierge, a service they've created called Comfort.
We provide them with, like, fresh bedding, clean clothes, toiletries. We pair people with community members so they can, you know, get a shower, sometimes, you know, get a good meal, nice, you know, rest. nobody gave us a roadmap to building a revolution, so we're kind of making it up as we go along.
How did all this happen? Cyber activist and writer David DeGraw helped shape its message.
2 years ago, I wrote a book called The Economic Elite versus the People of the United States. And in the book, I was calling for 99% of the population to unite on common ground, saying that both political parties, both Democrats and Republicans, have been bought off by global financial interests through a system of political bribery, which is campaign finance, lobbying, and the revolving door. And I felt that whether you were a Republican, a Democrat, a progressive, a libertarian, an independent, an anarchist, a communist, no matter what, there was plenty of common ground that we can come together on.
The crowds that packed the encampment now known as Occupy Wall Street has become a community with a map of its own, a map of how the park has been turned into its own village run by what they call work groups.
What you're seeing here is a religious service. This is Sunday. And various ministers and congregations, and in the past Muslims, have come to this park to show solidarity with the people here. But what I was curious about is, how is this organized? How did they manage to sustain so much interest and get so much attention? And that's what we've come to investigate.
It's become a little community here. And, you know, these are the kinds of things that you hope would happen in an environment like this. You don't usually see it until after some sort of a natural disaster. Well, this I call an unnatural disaster, what spurred it. And people are doing just what you hope they would do. Americans are very in tune to caring for each other. We have to.
Mic check. You can see that film online if you go to Press TV on YouTube. It's called Behind the Scenes of OWS, and I directed and produced it with a small team, and I think it's a good kind of snapshot. It's also on PRN.fm, and you can see this film and get a good snapshot of what it was like in the park, what was destroyed by the NYPD, but what, in a sense, how we want to live in a society where people care about each other and work towards building some sort of sustainable community. And that's also one of the things that Occupy Wall Street has brought to us, a vision of another kind of society here in America, not dominated by the 1%, but a society that's democratic and that's participatory. And that's why I made this film. Please have a look at it. Let me know what you think. You can write to me at dissector@mediachannel.org. Progressive Radio Network will have a podcast of this program available. If you found it interesting, please share it with others. That podcast will also be up on iTunes on the News Dissector radio program here. PlunderTheCrimeOfOurTime.com is the place to turn for more information about my films, and I blog every day at NewsDissector.com. That's a lot of URLs there to remember, but I think you'll find it of interest and of value. At least I hope so. So that's it for this week's program. We'll be back next week, same time, same station.
To chase and to walk home.